The evidence is overwhelming.
Billions of years.
Science has settled this.
But has it really?
He's a double major, physics and astronomy, holding a PhD in astrophysics from the same universities that teach what he now dismantles. He's also a published author, a Fortis Fellow, and a Christian who believes the Bible means exactly what it says. This is In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle.
Does the science of genetics confirm creation or evolution? Hi folks, I'm Jason Lyle with Fortis Institute, and I'm also the president and founder of the Biblical Science Institute. Today we're going to look at genetics, the study of heredity, the study of how traits are passed on from one organism to the next generation. And we want to see if the science here is consistent with what we would expect if Darwinian evolution were true, or if biblical creation were true. And so the first question I want to ask is, do animals change at all? As animals give rise to the next generation, are their descendants identical to the parents? And of course, the answer is, well, no, they're not identical. Animals do change. And so dogs, for example, do dogs change? Well, yeah, they do. But what do they change into? Other dogs. And so you can get different varieties of dogs by breeding them together and so on. That's how we have the different breeds that we have today, but they always remain dogs. And this is what I would expect as a biblical creationist, because the Bible teaches that God made organisms after their kinds, or after its kind. That's a phrase that's used 10 times in Genesis chapter 1. We better take it seriously. There's no doubt that animals reproduce according to their kind. That seems to be the reproductive limit because God brought two of each kind on board Noah's Ark to preserve life. So the kind is the reproductive limit of an organism. Now, it's important to recognize that kind is not the same thing as species. There's some confusion on this. Species is a very modern classification, but we do believe that you can get different species from one kind. For example, there have been experiments where they've taken mosquitoes that have been separated from their parent population, and after many generations, their descendants are no longer able to interbreed with the descendants of the parent population. And so they're classified as a new species, because they can't readily interbreed, but they're still mosquitoes. They always have been mosquitoes, and unfortunately, they always will be mosquitoes. But there's no evolution there at all. It's just mosquitoes begetting mosquitoes. And so it is with dogs. You can get the different breeds of dogs from just two dogs that we believe were on Noah's Ark. You can get all those different breeds. Yes, you can get different species, but they're still the same kind. Elephants, for example, we believe that the African elephant and the Indian elephant, although they are different species, they're the same kind. And we believe they're the same kind as some extinct varieties, like mammoths, for example. Although those are classified as different species, they're still the same kind. God has built into organisms the ability to produce descendants that are similar to them, but not identical. There's variation within a kind. That is what the Bible teaches, and so that's what we as creation scientists believe. I have to point out that sometimes evolutionists will misrepresent what creationists teach and say, oh, you know, creationists, they believe that God created every species as we see them today. Well, that's not true. We don't believe that animals are identical to the way they were back at creation. For example, I don't believe that there were poodles in the Garden of Eden, right? Because God called the world very good when it was first made. No, animals have changed a bit since creation, and we're going to see how that happens as we go along in this episode. So the biblical teaching would be variation within a kind. Organisms have always remained the same kind, but you can get variations and even speciation. On the other hand, evolution, the evolutionists teach really that there's only one kind, because in the evolutionary view, everything is related. Everything is descended from a common ancestor that lived billions of years ago. And in fact, something like a bacterium, a single-celled microbe, as it reproduced, eventually gave rise to everything else. And to see which of these views is most consistent with the study of genetics, we need to know a little bit about DNA. This is a very long molecule that occurs in the cells of our body, in the nucleus of those cells. And DNA, you've probably seen illustrations of it. It looks a bit like a twisted ladder. It's a double helix. And on the rungs of this ladder are chemicals called nucleotide base pairs. There are four different nucleotides that are used in living organisms, and they are abbreviated by the first letter of their name, C, G, A, and T. And on a given strand of DNA, you don't know which letter is going to come next. Will it be a C? Will it be an A? Will it be a G? Will it be a T? You can't tell. But the way those letters are arranged spells out the information to make a living organism. It's really remarkable. In the same way that I could spell help using Morse code, using dots and dashes, in much of the same way, I could write a book in DNA. It's just I'm using a four-letter alphabet instead of a 26-letter alphabet or a two-letter alphabet in the case of Morse code. The way it works is that groups of three of these nucleotide base pairs form kind of like a word, which we call a codon, and it represents something else. It'll either represent an amino acid, or it'll represent a start or stop in a sequence. And then these messages are copied and read by organelles called ribosomes, which read these messages and translate them into proteins. And then the proteins are what make up you. They're the basic structure of your body and how it works, the machinery that makes your body work. It's really remarkable. And the reason that you're a person and not a cabbage is because you have instructions to make a person, whereas a cabbage has DNA instructions to make a cabbage. And believe me, you got the long end of the stick on that one. Now, you might wonder, well, how do we have such differences in different people, different eye color, hair color, and so on? And the answer is because we have slight differences in our DNA, in our genetic instructions. A section of DNA that controls a trait is called a gene. And unless you have an identical twin, your genes are slightly different from everyone else on the planet. And so you have differences in eye color, hair color, skin shade, and so on. To make things even more interesting, you have two sets of DNA. You see, you get half of your genes from dad, you get half of your genes from mom, and it's the combination of those two sets of genes that determines your traits. And this is why it's possible for mom and dad to have many kids that look a little like dad, a little like mom, and then they have some traits that neither parent has because they have a unique combination of genes. And so that's why it's possible for you to have an eye color that neither of your parents has or a blood type that neither parent has. And in fact, I think it's easiest to understand this principle with blood types. There are three different possible genes that can determine blood type, and they're abbreviated A, B, or O. Those are the three combinations. Now, A and B are dominant genes, whereas O is recessive. And so if your combination is A and O, like if you get A from one parent and the O from the other parent, your blood type is A, because the A will dominate over the O. And if you have A and A, your blood type's A. If you have B and B, your blood type's B. If you have B and O, your blood type is still B, because the B is dominant over the O. If you have A and B, they're codominant, and so your blood type is AB. And the only way you can have blood type O is to get the O gene from each parent. And so your blood type then would be O, because you'd have an O from dad and O from mom. And so those are the four possible blood types in human beings: A, B, AB, and O. Now, what I find interesting is that if the parents have, let's say mom has blood type A, and let's say her specific genetic code is O and A, so that's what we call the heterozygous combination. And dad has blood type B, and let's say it's the heterozygous B, so he has O and B, then the children could have any possible blood type. They could get the A from mom, they could get the O from dad, and their blood type would be A. They could get the A from mom, the B from dad, their blood type would be AB. They could get the O from mom and the O from dad, their blood type is O. And so it's possible for them to have a blood type that neither parent has. And so you might notice that some of your traits look a little like dad, some of your traits look a little like mom, and you have some other traits, and you're like, where did that come from? Well, it still came from your parents, it's just you have a unique combination. This is an ingenious way of encoding a tremendous amount of variety into just two human beings. In fact, you take any two people, a married couple, the number of unique children they could have before statistically they'd end up with a duplicate DNA is greater than the number of atoms in the universe. That's the amount of variety that God has built into human beings, all of that built into Adam and Eve. It's the same with skin shade. There's a few different genes that cause skin shade to be either very dark or very light or somewhere in between, depending on how much melanin your body produces. Melanin is a pigment. There's a couple different forms of it. There's a gray form and a yellow form. But basically, if you have a lot of the dark melanin, you're going to be very dark skinned. If you have just a little bit, you're going to be light skinned. And it's possible for people to have a heterozygous combination where they have some dark genes and some light genes. And if they get married to someone in that category, even though the parents will both be kind of middle brown, their kids could be very light or very dark or middle brown like their parents. And so we think Adam and Eve probably had that combination, that heterozygous combination. And so their children could have had any skin shade from very dark to very light. So according to biblical creation, all the information that makes us was stored in Adam and Eve. On the other hand, if evolution is true, then that information was generated over billions of years because bacteria, single-celled organisms, do not have the instructions, the information to make the structures that we have, like eyeballs and skin and hair and so on. So if evolution is true, then bacteria, as they reproduced over millions of years, some of them gained brand new information, the information to make bones, hair, eyeballs, skin, blood vessels, and so on. So the question is, when we take a look at the science, do we find that brand new information is produced in the genome? So when we come back from this short break, we'll see if evolution can pay the bill.
And we'll be back with more from Dr. Lyle in just a moment, who's digging into genetics and what DNA actually tells us about creation. Let me ask you the question that Dr. Lyle keeps coming back to. Where does the information come from? It's the right question for science. It's also the right question for right now, because the teaching that you're listening to, it didn't write itself. It also didn't fund itself. There's a group of people, men and women, who continue to keep the train running. What does that mean? Well, they're gospel partners. They fund this work because they have been impacted by the content we're producing so much that they want to make sure that more people in more places all over the world also have access to it. And maybe that is you. Maybe you have benefited from something that you've heard on this ministry. If that's so, we would love to link arms with you. A couple of things, though. Make sure that you're giving to your local church first, because as a Christian, that is your number one giving priority. Your local church comes first, and we never want you to give to our ministry over your local church. Number two, we don't want you to give to our ministry if it would be a burden for you. Make sure those two areas of your life are in order, and if they are, you can go to FortisInstitute.org to get all the details about what it would look like in your life to join us as an ongoing monthly gospel partner. Now, I want to mention a couple of more things before we get back to Dr. Lyle. Number one, the Fortis Plus app. If you have not downloaded that to your smartphone, you are missing out, because it's stocked deeper than you would expect. The whole catalog from Dr. Jason Lyle is on there right now. Every resource he's ever created as a fellow here at Fortis Institute can be found there, alongside Dr. Adam Tyson, Dr. Greg Gifford, Pastor Brad Bigney, Libby Glosson, Todd Friel, Dr. John Krotz. You can find everything right there from all of our fellows on the Fortis Plus app, and we're adding content every single day, and it is absolutely free of charge, because of those gospel partners that I talked about. But make sure that you download it, because you're missing out on a well of information if you don't have it available to you. FortisPlus.org, you can go there, or you can download it to your smartphone or your smart TV. And one more thing that I want to mention to you before we get back to Dr. Lyle. You know someone in your life right now. Maybe it's your child, maybe it's your grandchild, it's a young person in your church, whoever it is, and they've been told that DNA proves they came from bacterium, what Dr. Lionel is talking about, and that's someone that needs to hear a scientist take that claim apart. Send them this episode. Let Dr. Lyle show them the actual science the classroom skipped. Send them this episode. Doesn't cost you a dime to hit share on your smartphone right now. Now let's get back to Dr. Jason Lyle. This is In the Beginning.
For me, when I study the universe, I'm studying the handiwork of God. I don't know how secular people do it. I don't know how they can enjoy something that they think is just chance.
And now back to In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle.
We've been looking at genetics, the study of heredity, and we've seen how the genes that contain the instructions to make our various features, how that information was stored in the genes of our parents and in their parents and so on, all the way back to Adam and Eve. On the other hand, if evolution were true, then single-celled organisms that did not have those instructions must have gained them at some point as they reproduced. And so evolution requires an increase in genetic information in order for it to be possible. And that's very interesting because the processes that we observe scientifically reduce genetic information or are perhaps neutral, but they do not increase it. And one example of this is natural selection. It's ironic that many people think that natural selection is the engine that makes evolution work, but when we study it, we'll find it's actually the opposite of evolution because it doesn't increase genetic information. It actually reduces it. So suppose, for example, that you had two dogs, a male and female, and suppose that each dog has one gene for short fur and one gene for long fur that they obtained from their parents, and suppose those genes have a combined effect, which many genes do, so that the dogs have medium-length fur because of their combination of short and long genes. Now, this is simplified, but the basic genetic principle here is true. Now, if those dogs reproduce, some of the pups will get the short gene from dad and the short gene from mom, and they'll have very short fur. Some dogs would get the short gene from one parent, the long gene from the other, and have medium-length fur just like their parents. In fact, statistically, 50% of the offspring would have that combination. And then some dogs would get the long gene from dad and the long gene from mom, and they would have very long fur. And so in one generation, you have all kinds of variety. You have new variations. You have dogs with long, medium, and short fur. Now, this isn't evolution because they're still dogs. And frankly, they have the same information in the offspring as the parents had, information for short, medium, and long. It's just that not all the combinations were expressed in the parents. Now, let's suppose the environment gets very cold. What's going to happen? Well, the dogs with the medium and short fur, they don't do so well in a cold environment because they're not well insulated. And so, worst case scenario, they die. Best case scenario, they are able to find shelter, but they're not able to find each other because they have to spend all their time finding shelter, whereas the dogs that have the long fur are well insulated against the cold, and they're able to find other dogs that have long fur, and when they reproduce, their pups are going to have long fur because that's the only combination left, is the L, the long combination. So just in one generation, we can see that due to changes in the environment, the dominant genetic traits are those that happen to be conducive to survival in that environment. And so the dogs would go to having long fur. And it's not that any particular dog said, hey, it's getting cold. I better grow some long fur. Not at all. The dogs that already had the long fur, because that was their genetic propensity, survived better in that environment and reproduced in greater numbers than the dogs that had the shorter or medium-length fur. Now, this is by definition natural selection. That's the definition of it. It's some organisms survive better than others and reproduce in greater numbers in a particular environment. But is this evolution? I mean, we started with dogs that had the short and long combination and therefore had medium fur, and we ended up with dogs that just had the long gene. So have we gained any new information? Of course not. In fact, we've actually lost some information. We lost the information for short fur and, by combination, medium fur. Those combinations no longer exist. Now, suppose that we started the experiment over. So we have all three varieties, long, medium, short. But this time, let's suppose the environment becomes very warm, very hot. Now, in this case, the dogs that have the medium and long fur, they don't do so well in that hot environment. They're more likely to die from heat stroke than the dogs that have the shorter fur. And so the dogs that survive, that are the most likely to survive and reproduce in that hot environment, are those dogs that have the short fur. And so they find other dogs that have short fur, and pretty soon, that's all the dogs that you find in that environment. This, again, is a great example of natural selection. But is there any evolution? Have the dogs gained any brand new information? Well, of course not. We started off with information for long and short, and by combination, medium. And when the experiment's done, the only varieties left are those with short. The information for long and by combination, medium fur has been lost. And so you see, natural selection really is the opposite of evolution because it doesn't increase the information in the genetic code. It actually reduces it. Natural selection is the opposite of evolution. And so it's very ironic indeed that Darwin tried to convince people that evolution is true by linking it to natural selection. He taught that natural selection was the mechanism by which evolution would occur, but now we see that it's actually the opposite, because natural selection cannot produce any new information. It simply refers to the elimination of those combinations that produce traits that are not conducive to survival in a particular environment. And we find that this principle is true. We find that certain organisms tend to thrive in certain environments, and if you transplant them to an environment that's not conducive to survival, given their traits, they tend to not do so well in that environment. Sure enough, dogs that end up in the cold, snowy climates, they tend to have longer, thicker fur. Dogs that are in very warm environments, they tend to have short, thinner fur. And if they didn't, well, they wouldn't do so well in that environment. You've probably noticed that different plants grow in different regions of the world. And so you go down to tropical places and you'll find things like palm trees, things that you won't find in the mountains of Colorado, for example, because they don't thrive in that environment. But this is all consistent with biblical creation, with God having planted certain information in the genome of the original organisms, and then some of that's been lost over time as certain varieties of organisms died out, at least in a particular environment. Now, evolutionists will say, oh, but it's not just natural selection, it's natural selection and mutations that drive evolution. So what's a mutation? Well, a mutation basically is a mistake in your DNA. It's sometimes produced when the DNA is being copied during the process of reproduction. That process isn't absolutely perfect in a fallen world, and so occasionally you'll get a typo in your DNA. That's really what a mutation is. And as you might imagine, they're not good for you. Mutations can lead to all kinds of disease and so on, although some of them are just sort of inconvenient. For example, dogs should have information for four normal healthy legs, but there is a mutation or combination of mutations that causes a dog to occasionally be born with short, stubby little legs. This is because he's lost some information, and so his legs don't form properly. They're still functional, but they're much shorter than they should be. And if you think about it, a dog like that that has very short, stubby little legs is not going to do very well in the wild because he can't run very fast. He can't get away from predators. He can't catch anything himself. He's not going to do so well in the wild. Some mutations are immediately lethal. They cause the heart or some other vital organ not to form properly, and those mutations are immediately eliminated because the organism dies. And so we find that in the wild, mutations are held back to some extent because they reduce the survivability of a particular organism. Even mutations that are not immediately lethal, like having short, stubby little legs, nonetheless reduce the ability of an organism to survive. But some people like dogs that have short, stubby little legs, and so they will take these dogs into their households and care for them so the dog doesn't have to survive in the wild. He has a human caretaker to tend to all of his needs. And so you'll find that domestic breeds of dogs tend to be full of mutations. As one example, poodles have a mutation that causes their hair to grow forever. Remember how dogs are supposed to have a gene that regulates the growth of their fur, so it can be short or medium or long. But with poodles, that gene is damaged, and so their hair grows indefinitely. Now, there's no way that poor animal could possibly survive in the wild, because once its hair gets beyond a certain length, it's not going to be able to see, it's not going to be able to move. And so human beings need to give your poodle a haircut every now and then, but you'll never find a poodle in the wild. So are mutations an example of evolution? Well, hardly. As we've seen, they actually remove instructions from the DNA, and so they actually reduce the information content. They do not increase it. And this confuses some people because there are occasional mutations that will actually help an organism to survive in a particular environment. But the point is, they do so by removing information, not increasing it, and therefore they can't possibly help evolution. For example, there is a bacterium called H. pylori that causes stomach ulcers. And of course, you don't like that, so you go to your doctor and he gives you an antibiotic. The antibiotic, which your cells cannot process, is absorbed in the bacterium, and he's got an enzyme that's part of his system that, when it reacts with that antibiotic, converts it into a poison, and then the poison kills the bacterium, and you feel better. Well, there is a mutated form of H. pylori that lacks the ability to produce that enzyme. He's missing some instructions, and so he can't produce it. And therefore, when the antibiotic goes into him, it just sits there. He lacks the ability to convert it into a poison because he's missing some instructions. And so this is how you get antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And sometimes those can be a problem at hospitals. But is this evolution? Not at all, because he hasn't gained any new information. He's still a bacterium, and he always will be. Mutations never add brand new instructions to the genome. In fact, Dr. Lee Spetner, PhD in biophysics at Johns Hopkins University, says, quote, "Not even one mutation has been observed that adds a little information to the genome," end quote. So scientifically, we have never observed even a single example of the kind of information increase that would be necessary to make evolution work. The science is consistent with biblical creation. Thanks for listening. God bless.
This has been In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle, a production of Fortis Institute. Our website is fortisinstitute.org, and it is your central hub for all things Fortis. If you've enjoyed In the Beginning with Dr. Jason Lyle, consider subscribing and sharing with your friends and church family. Also, would you prayerfully consider joining this labor of love by becoming an ongoing monthly gospel partner? And until next time, go serve your King.